When comedian Sacha Baron Cohen assumed the identity of Kazakhstani journalist Borat at a press conference in Washington, D.C. in 2006, a percentage of the media outlets were not in on the joke, and some networks actually portrayed his backward, ignorant presentation of Kazakhstan as a cultural chasm and nothing more. In reality, he was simply using the ice water in his veins to promote his upcoming movie, also known as Borat. He did, however, have a predecessor in Mr. Frank Abagnale, the American hoaxer chronicled in his book, and a movie based on that called Catch Me If You Can. Abagnale successfully worked as an airline pilot and even a residential surgeon before finally being discovered and shown the ways of what can be diplomatically called compensatory litigation. But these hoaxers are all just pretenders to the throne. Because in 1910, a small group of restless artisans scammed a British flagship into a set of diplomatic concessions, ceremonial honors, and even possibly a violation of classified informational issues. Today, we will discover what is known as the Dreadnought Hoax. And this is box number 7. In 1906, the Royal Navy placed into commission what would become at the time the most technologically advanced warship to enter the fleet. It was called the HMS Dreadnought. Not only would the ship carry the cutting edge of technological acumen, but it would also become the avatar for the fleet that at the time posed the greatest nautical hope for the maintenance of world peace. The psychological impact was so significant that it is estimated that 1 million people may have turned out to witness the arrival of the Dreadnought to London in 1909 alone. Well, needless to say, the meteoric ascension of legend, the elevation of anything that goes from sea level to stratospheric heights, metaphorical or otherwise, always, always demands the quasi-Newtonian equal and opposite reaction. In this case, a small band of hoaxers that could pierce the impregnable magisterial bubble and, as they say, equalize the markets of ego. In fact, one of the 6 conspirators, Miss Virginia Stevens, in recalling the hoax 30 years later, stated that this was exactly the point. She discussed how Horace Devercole, her co-conspirator, worked up an idea that would lead ultimately to them sending a most precocious telegram. Quote, "The officers of the Hawk and the Dreadnought had a feud, and Cole's friend, who was on the Hawk, had come to Cole and said to him, 'You're a great hand at hoaxing people. Couldn't you do something to pull the leg of the Dreadnought? They want taking down a bit. Couldn't you manage to play off one of your jokes against them?'" Unquote. So when Admiral Sir William May, the commander-in-chief of the Home Fleet, received a wire that a small group of Abyssinian dignitaries, in this case the royal family, were seeking a diplomatic tour of the Dreadnought, he was at first, naturally, apprehensive. The telegram read, quote, "Prince Michaelin of Abyssinia and suite will arrive at 4:20 today at Weymouth. He wishes to see the Dreadnought. Kindly arrange to meet them on arrival." Unquote. So while all these diplomatic interruptions were being considered, Cole and Virginia's brother and author, who was psychoanalyst Adrian Stephen, started preparing the others. This was comprised of author Guy Ritchie, British soldier and author Anthony Buxton, and artist Duncan Grant, and along with Virginia Stephen, of course, to don their makeup, skin darkeners, and regional costumes of the Abyssinian royalty. The precarious nature for the makeup came with a myriad of concerns, though, primarily the fact that the crew was most likely going to regale them with food and drink, and the very hint of moisture or food residue was going to mess with the makeup, the dye jobs, the spirit gum, and applied facial hair. Virginia especially required an absence of technical problems in this case, as she was already dealing with a baseline requirement that no one else had, and that was needing to conceal very stark female characteristics, especially on the face. The other issue would be the credible presentation of a language that none of them spoke. Cole, he provided them these placards and materials that covered basic Abyssinian, but at some point he basically instructed them to wing it, and none of the crew would hopefully suspect a thing unless they were in proximity to one of the other hoaxers presenting something of an absurdly different, contrasting nature of falsehood. They all agreed to employ the comical phrase, "Bunga Bunga," as an exclamatory expression whenever they wanted to convey astonishment or awe during their tour. Oh, and Adrian Stephen would assume the role of interpreter to clarify any confusion and head off any uncomfortable acquaintances. Well, everything was set, and a ragtag group of faux Abyssinians was ready to roll, head wraps and all. Cole, with his entourage, he went to London's Paddington Station, where Cole assumed the name, I hope I can pronounce this, but it was Herbert Cholmondeley, or possibly Cholmondeley, of the Foreign Office, and demanded that a special train to Weymouth be provided. The station master arranged a VIP coach after a small degree of resistance. Well, he got his wish. He got the train. He got the travel, and he got the presentation. And at this point, it seems that the desire for diplomatic deference took all the momentum with it from this point forward. In Weymouth, the Navy welcomed the princes with an honor guard and music. A frantic search amongst the inventory of flags did not produce an Abyssinian flag, but no matter, the flag of Zanzibar was substituted, and the Zanzibar national anthem was played in lieu of the accompanying musical chasm that was presented to them in short time. This could not have gone any more along the lines of anything other than what we could call a serendipitous route. One of the naval officers aboard, Willie Fisher, happened to be a cousin of Virginia and Adrian, but he failed to recognize them through their costumes. Nor did the irony of his alarm at Adrian's apparent German accent when he believed he thought there was possibly a German spy on board. Cole saw the issue arising and realized that their cover was going to be blown soon, and he abruptly constructed a narrative of a sudden need to be exiting the premises. Adrian Stephen had to use his interpretive role to head off offers of food and drink, citing improper preparation as their excuse to turn down the food, and he also guided the delegation as it was shown around the ship. The foreigners exulted in their mix of stylized Greek, Latin, and Swahili, and of course, bunga bunga. The return trip would prove to be just as useful, by the way. Crowds gathered at Weymouth to see the princes board as they headed back for London. All of this travel, by the way, arranged backwards by the Royal Navy, of course. And as Cole boarded the train, he sneezed and almost blew his cover as half of his own fake mustache took a detour. He was fortunately able to use his hand to cover it and turn his head away from the window as he was waving at the adoring crowds. Living off the adrenaline of this success, however, the delegation decided to extend one more set of duplicitous parameters. Cole told the waitstaff on the train that the Abyssinian custom was such that they could only receive food from people wearing kid gloves. So when the train stopped at Reading, a man was sent to buy the gloves to make sure the Abyssinians did not go hungry. They made it home with no immediate fanfare, at least at first. And the aftermath of this hoax was a combination of things bitter and sweet as well. When the prank became a known factor back in England, the ringleader, Horace de Vere Cole, he immediately contacted the press and sent a photo of the princes and himself and Adrian Stephen to the Daily Mirror. The group's pacifist views were considered sort of a source of embarrassment, but the Royal Navy briefly became an object of ridicule because of this, and the dreadnought was severely, severely upbraided from the military for its systemic violations, obvious security and intelligence breaches notwithstanding. The Navy later demanded that Cole, the ringleader, be prosecuted, but it was shown that Cole and his compatriots had not broken any law. Embarrassing the Royal Navy was not a prosecutable act. Instead, all the co-conspirators, with the exception of Virginia Stevens, were subjected to a symbolic thrashing on the buttocks by the junior Royal Navy staffers. So it was sort of a phony court case with symbolic punishments meted out. However, Anthony Buxton, who did have legitimate military connections, was allegedly taken by his military uppers and actually caned on the buttocks and possibly everywhere else on his backside for his involvement in this. The Dreadnought itself would become the only Royal Navy ship to ram and sink a German vessel during the war, to which a plethoric amount of correspondence came in with these amazing congratulatory tidings, one of which read in capital letters, "Bunga, bunga." There was even an ad hoc reworking of an old English folk song, "The Girl I Left Behind," to which they sang these rhythmic phrases. "When I went on board a dreadnought ship, I looked like a costermonger. They said I was an Abyssinian prince, 'cause I shouted, bunga, bunga." Oh, and one last thing. As I stated before, Adrian Stephen did board the dreadnought to conduct this elusive hoax with his compatriots, one that did include his own sister, a one Virginia Stephen. First of all, how cool to have a sister that's down for something like this and will go all the way to the mat, that will go hard in the paint with her kid brother. Virginia Stephen, however, was already a known quantity at this point and far less obscure than her brother. She was author, provocateur, and complicated soul that would tragically end her own life by drowning in 1941. In this story, you know her as Virginia Stephen, but the world knows her as esteemed writer and author, Virginia Woolf. And this is Box Number 7.